Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Michelle Ephraim, author and professor of English at Worcester Polytechnic Institute, and we're talking about her new book, a memoir, Green World, a tragicomic memoir of love and Shakespeare. Michelle, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
And it's a great pleasure to be here. Thanks so much.
Now, I don't cover a lot of memoirs. I do cover some. And the question I always have for people who are writing memoirs is, how do you come to that decision? Because, well, let me explain that, and maybe we can talk about this for a bit. Because that means you're putting yourself out there for public scrutiny.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is, and that leads to what do you leave in and what do you leave out? So let's talk about the challenges of writing a memoir, because it's, to me, it seems very challenging.
Yes. That question of why, I often ask myself that in the midst of, you know, yet another draft of this manuscript. Why am I doing this? The idea for the memoir actually came from an essay that I wrote that was published by the Washington Post. And it was about how my job, I realized, was actually a very hazardous profession. after I lost my father, I realized that it was a very dangerous profession. My cushy job as a professor, because I basically had to come into class and talk about Shakespeare and talk about people losing their parents, grief, all day, every day. So it was very stressful, that job. So that essay got such a great response from people. I got so many emails from the obvious, you know, Shakespeare nerds, but then from people who claimed they didn't really know or like Shakespeare at all, but very much felt that I had touched on grief so accurately by through talking about Shakespeare.
And still.
But
you have to be, okay, there's one thing to write a short piece about it.
Right.
You have to come, as you examine different aspects of your life, and that is all in here. Did you first of all have to wait till both of your parents had passed before you decided to do this?
Well, my father had already passed away, but my mother, you know, long story short, I think I really couldn't finish it until she died.
Okay. And I understand.
Because I think I needed more critical distance. And I guess that sort of answers, maybe that's part of the answer of your initial question of how can you put yourself out there? And I think, you know, anyone who's written a memoir will probably know what I'm talking about, where at a certain point you have to understand yourself in the book as a persona, as a character.
You have to have critical
distance. That does not prevent you from waking up in the middle of the night before it comes out, before it's published, and realizing, oh my God, what have I just done? well, I'll speak for myself.
I totally get that.
Yeah. Right. What have I done? And also, it's too late now.
Oh, God.
I'm back to sleep. Right.
Well, one of the sub-stories of this book is really a critical look at the bureaucracy of the academic world.
Yes.
And did you burn any bridges writing this book?
I might have to get back to you on that. No, you know, I think that, a lot of people did tell me that, you know, the book should have a trigger warning on it for people who've gone through the tenure process, which makes so much sense.
Oh, God.
And now I, you know.
Oh, I totally get that now after reading your book.
Right.
I didn't know how any of that worked.
Right.
And so reading that section, those parts which go throughout the latter half of the book, I found fascinating. And also, you know, well, this is just really screwed up, and and makes no sense. It's really not a humane way to run a process like this at all.
Right. I mean, I will say everyone's tenure process is obviously different. Every institution is different. Every department is different. So this is by no means, you know, this is what happens everywhere. It depends who's in charge. It depends on all these things. But I do think there's some commonalities. You know, I think that certainly the feeling that you're being hazed in some way is something that a lot of people relate to. It does begin to take on kind of, as you say, you know, kind of, you know, inhumane quality
to it.
And having critical distance from it, you know, is also very liberating as well. In terms of burning bridges, like I said, you know, I think it's more that people relate to it. And I think it's what you do with it. I think it's important to remember how hard it was going through the tenure process, because then you realize that you should be kind to people who are in vulnerable positions like that.
Exactly.
You know, to not increase the anxiety that they already have.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Yeah. Now, were there also parts that you felt you thought about putting in, and then eventually you went, no, I'm not going to put this in. Either it's too personal or, you know, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think – I'm not sure if there was a line of that's too personal, as you know, because you've just read this book, so you know it's extremely personal.
It's very personal, but there are personal aspects. Like, you're not detailing your sex life. That's a weird example. but things
well,
like that.
There is one unfortunate sex scene, but yeah.
Yeah, there is one very unfortunate sex scene.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, I would never talk about my children in any great detail. That's
what I thought.
I guess, you know, it's funny you asked that, because my agent, who gave me incredible feedback on this book, that there was a point where she's like, you know what, you got to cut some of these anecdotes about your mom, because she really comes across as insane. And it was sort of a great moment where it was like, but all of these are true, but you still have to, you know, you have to make her a character that readers will like. And so from the millions of anecdotes of things from her life that were meaningful to me, I had to sort of curate.
But see, that's interesting, because you know, everybody hears that it's a memoir, but obviously it's as curated as a novel is.
Absolutely. That is one of the things that I learned in writing this, actually. Yeah. I thought I knew what I was doing when I started writing this. And it was incredibly humbling, because I really had to, you know, at a certain point, I had to stop and just study memoirs, just study published memoirs and how they were built.
Yep.
And that was a very important step for me. But I got to understand how crafted they were. And I think the irony is that the better crafted they are, the more authentic it becomes.
Is there a memoir that you really, or two, that you really hold in high regard?
Yeah. Well, there's so many. Oh, my gosh.
Okay. Well, name one or two.
Yeah. I love Alexandra Fuller's Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight. I think that's the right title. Hopefully I'm remembering that correctly. And that I thought was an absolutely phenomenal memoir. And what that memoir taught me was that no matter how grim things are in the events that you're narrating, you have to leave the reader with something hopeful at the end. So Alexandra Fuller, I think, is a phenomenal memoirist. Joan Didion, there's so many, fabulous memoirists and memoirs out there. But yeah, Alexandra Fuller's really, really stuck with me a lot. I found myself thinking about that for sure.
Now, this is also a book about family. And what to make out of your family. And it's also it's an interesting memoir about you coming to terms with your Jewishness.
Yes.
And it's a complicated situation. So let's talk. Well, it's complicated because of the way you were raised. Let's talk about your mother and father. Say a few words about both.
Right. So they understood their relationship as very fated. As in F-A-T-E-D, fate. They were both born in Germany the same year, same day. They both fled Germany, one Berlin, the other Hamburg, in 1939. Each was 8 years old. They fled because of the Nazis. They were both Jewish. Both families, you know, lost members in the camps. So they both fled Germany. My mother's family went to London. My father's family went to the Philippines. They were there during the Japanese invasion of the Philippines years later. So, they both, when they both came to America at different times, my mother didn't come to the States till her late 20s. My father, when he was 13. And they were very traumatized people. And although they were very Jewish, in the sense of their past, they were very skeptical of American Jews. They had very mixed feelings about them, deeply ambivalent. They wanted to assimilate. They wanted me to assimilate. But they were also kind of pissed off at American Jews, and they resented.
That's the part that I found fascinating. Yeah.
Yeah.
Your father had a closer emotional tie to people from the Philippines than he did to American Jewish community here.
100%. 100%. And to Germans.
Well, that was the other weird thing. He resented the Nazis because they essentially screwed up Germanness for him.
Right. Right. Yeah. They screwed it. Yeah, right. He wanted to, you know, he was German and they made him leave. And, you know, they were definitely, my father more than my mother, but the two of them together, they were definitely drawn to people who were from Germany or from Europe, more so than Americans, and especially American Jews. And that was, you know, that was definitely a tension that was happening, especially because we lived in a neighborhood where there were a lot of Jewish families, but they were just extremely different from my parents. And I know that my parents felt, especially my mother, that they were looking down on her, you know, being an immigrant, et cetera. So it was fascinating. And I don't know if that was just my mother's perspective, although I suspect that it was true. But they also didn't feel particularly close to those people. So it wasn't like they were particularly open about connecting to the families around us either.
It's fascinating reading your accounts of growing up in this household and books.
Yeah, yeah.
Talk about that, because that was startling. Well, I mean, at one point, right. I forget who it was, people start questioning about whether you're abused.
Yes, yeah. It was in high school that I got, pulled aside by two teachers who had sort of planned this intervention. They had a meeting with me, and they asked me whether I was being abused. And it was incredibly shocking to me because my parents wouldn't lay a hand on me. I mean, they didn't hit me. And that's what I thought about as abuse. Right. And then I thought, oh my God, I've gotten them in trouble. I've done something and they're going to get in trouble in some way. Because I'm acting like I'm abused. and they're going to, God knows what's going to happen to them. But you know, in retrospect, I understand why they asked me that question, and it's complicated, because there was a lot of emotional abuse going on and a lot of verbal abuse going on. But I didn't understand it that way at the time. It was just, you know, my parents. But in terms of books in the house, we weren't a particularly literary family. One of the things I talk about in Green World is how my parents weren't readers of, you know, the great Western, you know, books of literature, the quote-unquote canon, the traditional canon. The sense that I got, or certainly in retrospect, is that, you know, these were books written by snobby white Christians. And again, kind of like with the people around us, Americans, it's like, well, you know, they would reject us, so we're going to reject them. You know, it sort of went both ways. So those were not the books that we had in our house at all. And what my father did very much like were, surprise, German books. And when I was a child, and Green World begins this way, he's reading me Grimm's fairy tales. And he loved to read all those kind of German, scary German fairy tales to me. And that's really my first memory of books.
Shock-headed Peter.
And Shock-headed Peter, yeah.
The Scissor Man. The Scissor Man sounds like a contemporary horror movie.
Right. So you weren't familiar with this book, right?
Not as a child, but as an adult, I know about it. Absolutely.
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
But it's still weird.
Yes, Der Stuhlvorpeter. So it's all these really disturbing stories of children who, you know, meet their ends in all sorts of ways. They get burned to death. They starve themselves to death. They're dismembered by creepy men who burst through the door with scissors. I mean, it's all sorts of horror.
Oh my God.
And this was like, you know, like practically, you know, it was like a soothing, like, stories that he read me, like, you know, not every day, but I would say that was just sort of our go-to storybook.
And these books had to be put back in the bookcase exactly so.
Mm-hmm.
And you,
yes.
Yeah. And when you didn't do that, there was all hell to pay.
Yeah. So my father, you know, again, you know, they were what I would call now, in retrospect, you know, they had experienced really deep, deep trauma. And my father was extremely rigid, you know, almost in kind of, I guess you would say now, like a OCD way of you had to do things a certain way. You know, that made no sense, you know, like, right, putting books back a certain way, holding them a certain way, putting things in a certain specific place that, you know, weren't logical, but they were just about exerting control and order in some way. But maybe that's just being very German. I don't know. So part of it is sort of, you know.
But here you are. Well, anyways, you're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Michelle Ephraim, author and professor of English at Worcester Polytechnic Institute. And we're talking about her new book. It's a memoir, and it's really a fascinating and complex read. Green World, a tragicomic memoir of love and Shakespeare. You know, we should talk about what the green world was.
Yeah.
It's a Shakespearean concept, and it actually shows up in other literature too. But what was it?
Yeah, so green world is a literary term used by Shakespeareans to describe a place that young characters go within a play to escape their oppressive families. So they have this idea that in this green world, and it's called that because it's usually like a forest or something like that. People who know the plays, Midsummer Night's Dream or As You Like It, classic green world plays. and these young people flee and they undergo some kind of transformation. They think they're finally going to escape home and get what they want, but eventually they have to return home. And that's the main meaning of green world, as I use it. But it's also a reference to the great state of Wisconsin, where part of this book takes place.
That's right. You thought that was green world, except in wintertime where it became frozen eyeball world.
Right, exactly. That's a frozen eyeball world. That doesn't make for as good a title, though. So, green world.
Well, here's we're obviously skipping around, and we're just generally giving you an idea of what this book is about. But you find yourself in a world where you should have been reading Shakespeare and you hadn't. So you had to sort of make up on that. And of all the plays to gravitate towards, which I just found The Merchant of Venice, which some people say you shouldn't be teaching that because it's anti-Semitic.
Right. Yes, I get asked that a lot.
And there's a tremendous analysis that's actually tucked into this book, too. But you gravitate a lot towards, obviously, Jessica in particular, and Shylock, and what their motives are and what they're feeling. And there's a quote, "Our house is hell," that sort of figures at the front and the back of this book. Talk to me about gravitating towards that play of all.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, it was very familiar to me, that play. So it was very exciting. You know, at that point, I was officially studying Shakespeare. I was studying for a big exam. So I had to read all these plays that I hadn't read yet, a lot of them. And one of them was The Merchant of Venice. So I was just reading it, honestly, because I had to. I don't remember whether I even knew what it was about before I cracked it open, you know? I really don't. But I couldn't believe it. I mean, it was, you know, I was used to connecting to things in Shakespeare at that point. That's what drew me to Shakespeare. But The Merchant of Venice, I had no idea that Shakespeare wrote about this dysfunctional Jewish family. I'm like, what? You know? So it was incredibly exciting to read it and disturbing, but I sort of felt that there was something, you know, very authentic about it. You know, here you have Shylock and
you don't think deeply
traumatized man.
You don't think Shakespeare's characterization of Shylock is really anti-Semitic?
I mean, that's a huge question that
I know.
That requires.
I was straight lining you.
I would say, you know, and maybe I take a rose-colored glasses, you know, view to Shakespeare in some ways, but I have to say that, you know, my authentic reading of the play is that he is, among other things, pointing out Christian hypocrisy that he's really pushing that a lot in the play. He is absolutely, in my argument about the play, showing how Christians are very hypocritical in trying to differentiate themselves from Shylock, which is not to say that he isn't drawing on stereotypes about Jews and, you know, the way that anti-Semitic characters have traditionally been written in medieval and early modern literature.
Wow.
Absolutely he has. He's doing so in the play. But I think that his depiction of Shylock is also so nuanced and emotionally uncomfortable for the Christians in the play.
And now you know why she's a good professor. I can see I can hear the discussions now in your class.
Right, right.
I think that's
cool. But, you know, I think that the issue of Shylock is really important. And honestly, there are a lot of professors, Jewish and not Jewish, who won't teach this play.
That's right. You talk about that in the book.
Yeah. Because they're worried that it's like, oh, I'm promoting something that's really negative, that's too problematic. I can't, you know, encourage this to be out in the world and for students to be reading, you know, what feels like anti-Semitic literature. I teach it very differently, and I think it's important to understand the history of Jewish representations, even when they're uncomfortable. Maybe because they're uncomfortable, too. That's another reason to study them.
That's right. Now, let's change gears entirely and talk about your love life in this book. Because there's a dalliance.
Oh, wow. Okay.
There's a dalliance early on with Hank. Was he a classic cad? Because he sort of seems like a colossal rectal sphincter. And yet, because you were young and inexperienced, you sort of fell into that trap. As you described him, he was sexy and brilliant. And the way you reacted to his family life, I just felt so heartsick for you.
Yeah.
You felt utterly illiterate, you know, but they were the classic sort of waspy, rich jerks.
Yeah. Jew wasps.
That's what they were.
Yeah.
I mean, it was like, and the way he dumped you, making conversation now. Holy crap. That whole section seemed like it should be a film.
I mean, you know, someone asked me, you know, someone who didn't know him or me or whatever said, are you worried that he's going to like come after you? I'm like, no, if anything, I make him look good. You know?
Well, I'm not so sure.
I mean, I'm telling you.
For smart women. No.
No, of course he's, you know,
but the sex was good.
He's a bad character, but I mean, I have to say, you know, I kind of love him as a character.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there was so much to work with. It was like, wow, thanks. This is great material. You know, who knew? But I did have to have affection for him as a character in order to craft him.
You're
in
right.
The book.
You're absolutely right.
I couldn't write Hank feeling angry at him or feeling, you know, whatever, hurt or feeling, you know, anything. I'm recalling those feelings, which, of course, were very deep at the time, and took me a while to get over. But certainly in writing it, you have to have a critical distance to create what that experience was like. Again, that sort of interesting irony, I think, that I learned about in learning how to write.
Oh, wow. Like I said, it's cinematic, as is your confrontation with one Stephen Greenblatt.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
Oh, my God. First of all, let's not give out too many details because people need to read the book. But that face-to-face confrontation and first of all, the buildup to Stephen Greenblatt and then the face-to-face confrontation was just, whoa. That's like a nightmare.
Yeah, it was. It was a nightmare. And I marvel at, because I remember shaking, like physically shaking and feeling sick, you know, all those cliched things were just like, you know, shaking, dizzy, sick. You think you're going to pass out. You know, I still have that memory of the visceral experience of it. It was so profound.
And everybody's watching.
Yeah, there were people watching. But it was.
But as one of your professors said, it's like, no, it can only help your career.
Right, which I just thought, you're crazy and drunk and, you know, which, you know, might have been both of those things but at the time. But, yeah, I mean, people, I will say people did have a perverse fascination with it. you know, some people were just truly, it took me a long time to be able, you know, until I could actually talk about what had happened. Because one, I didn't want people to know what had happened, obviously. I wanted to keep that under wraps because it was humiliating. And I feel like I felt like I'd so screwed up. You know, I didn't want anyone to know what had happened. So I didn't tell people. And it took a long time for me to sort of, you know, put my toe in the water and feel like, okay, can I tell people what happened?
Oh, yeah.
And then it took a long time. And then when I did, you know, I remember actually sitting with a group of other Shakespeare professors at a dinner, and I told them the story, and they were just dying laughing. And I realized, like, okay, part of it's that, you know, Stephen Greenblatt is so famous and successful that it's okay to laugh, you know?
We're out of time.
Oh.
I want to ask you one more question, just yes or no. Your mother dated Harold Pinter?
Yes.
Okay. People need to read the book to find out more details about that. That floored me. My guest tonight has been Michelle Ephraim, author and professor of English at Worcester Polytechnic Institute. And we're talking about her new book, a memoir, and there's a lot in there, as you can probably tell from our discussion. Green World, a tragicomic memoir of love and Shakespeare. Michelle, it's been a pleasure.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. This has been great.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.